It's Wednesday, March 30th, 2005, and 8:35 in the morning. And I called the House Committee on Trade and Economic Development to order. I'd like to begin with the House Bill 2013. And I'd like to let's have the public hearing and testimony. And who wants to begin first?
Would you like me to summarize it for you?
Okay. And Lynn Patton from the Governor's Office. Thank you.
Would you like me to summarize it for you?
Yes. Okay, hold on.
Mr. Chair, this is House Bill 2013. It creates an 11-member organ advocacy commission to combine and replace the Commission on Hispanic Affairs, Commission on Black Affairs, Commission on Asian Affairs. Appropriates a blank amount for operation of the commission. Abolishes the three commissions. And effective January 1st, 2006, you have the -1 amendment, which retains the commissions, and it directs the Department of Administrative Services to establish qualifications for and appoint the administrator of the Oregon Advocacy Commission's office. It requires the department to consult with commissions served by office before appointing the administrator. It replaces directors with administrators, and it provides for geographic representation to the extent possible in appointments to the commissions. The commissions are four commissions: commissions on Hispanic Affairs, commission on Asian Affairs, commission on Black Affairs, commission for women. It sets appointment terms for members of the Commission for Women, allows the governor to designate chairperson of the Commission for Women, requires the Commission for Women to meet at least three times annually, and allows the Commission for Women to receive and accept funds for purposes for which it was created.
All right. With that, I'd like to welcome Lynn. Glad to see you again. And please give us what you have in mind.
Thank you so much, Chair Lim. For the record, my name is Lynn Parton. I'm here on behalf of the Governor's Office. I want to thank all the members of the committee very much for hearing this bill today, in particular particularly for Chair Lim, who is both the sponsor of this, obviously is offering to hear it, and has also been willing to amend it. I am here because the amendment makes it identical to Senate Bill 359, A. Engrossed, which was at the request of the governor in the first place. It forms part of his recommended budget. I gave you the budget pages, I-14 and I-15, for those who are playing along at home. And that describes what each of the commissions currently is supposed to do and describes the general fund impact and the full-time equivalent, et cetera. With the -1 amendments, that passed unanimously out of Senate General Government Committee. So it comes to you in a different form, Matt, but in the same text. I'd like to emphasize that House Bill 2013, as hopefully amended here, is here as a substantive bill in a substantive committee. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, as does Senate Bill 359, and Senate Bill 5502, which is the funding mechanism, is already in Ways and Means. So this just sets up the structure for saving the commissions. I would like to introduce the people who really know about the problems that the commissions have been facing and the solution that this bill is trying to provide. From the Commission for Asian Affairs, Carol Suzuki.
Okay.
And Commission on Black Affairs, Amber Harper. Commission on Hispanic Affairs, Francisca Leva Johnson, over here. And Commission for Women, Rosalind Farrington. And unless the committee has questions for me, I will turn it over to them at this point.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Ms. Parton, I served on the Task Force for Women, and I also served on the Commission on Hispanic Affairs. However, and I'm supportive of this bill mostly, however, I'm concerned why we're leaving out several of the other minorities.
Representative Lim, Representative Nelson, one of the things that was considered was a broader-ranging human rights commission. The governor's office looked at a number of different options. And one of the concerns, frankly, was that a human rights coalition or commission that would be broad-ranging would be politically unfeasible in the current climate, especially given ballot measure 36 and some other things. And we really wanted to do something that could save what we had without kind of losing the fight across the board.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
Is there a reason we just don't have a commission for on minorities? Without all the other stuff you just talked about?
Representative Lynn, Representative Nelson, that, as far as I know, and that's before I was in the governor's office, but as far as I know, that was not discussed specifically.
Thank you.
And Representative Nelson, when do you mean to supporting this bill, that the original bill, House Bill 2013, or are you talking about the amendment?
I'm talking about House Bill 2013 or the amendment.
Or the amendment.
Yes, where we include all minorities. Right. I don't like discrimination in any form.
Okay. There's two... okay, we can discuss that later, okay? All right. So would you like to... I'd like to welcome the members of the advocacy committee of Black Affairs, Hispanic Affairs, Asian Affairs. Okay, pardon me. As a courtesy, I'd like to give the first opportunity to the Representative Tomei. And so would you may stay there and give a chair to the Representative Tomei. And I'd like to welcome you. Thank you for coming.
Oh, thank you, Chair Lim. I appreciate you being willing to hear me.
Thank you.
Chair Lim and members of the committee. Oh, I've got this. Forget all of your For the record, I am State Representative Carolyn Tomei, representing House District 41, encompassing the city of Milwaukee in southeast Portland. I've been appointed by Speaker Menas to serve as the legislative representative to the Oregon Commission for Women. I'm also co-chair of the Oregon Women's Health and Wellness Alliance, and this bill is part of our legislative package. Thank you for allowing me to testify today in support of this bill and the Dash 1 Amendment. I'd like to especially thank and recognize Chair Lim for proposing the original bill and for the time he's committed to putting the amendment together. The Dash 1 Amendment will include the Oregon Women's Commission and the Oregon Advocacy Commission's office. The Commission for Women promotes equality for women through education and communication with policymakers at all levels of government and the private sector. The Commission also participates in special events including the annual Women of Achievement Dinner celebration of Oregon Women and Women's History Month. Starting in 2001, the Commission for Women has administered the statewide AmeriCorps program, Communities in Partnership to Stop Violence Against Women and Children. This program, colleagues, brings over $800,000 to our state through a federal grant and serves over 12,000 domestic violence survivors in Oregon. This program and the federal dollars that come with it will cease to exist if the Commission for Women is forced to close its doors. So we need to ensure that the Commission for Women continues its operations. Oregon would face a huge loss by letting such a successful domestic violence prevention program slip away. Colleagues, I urge you to support this bill and to adopt the Dash 1 Amendment. And thank you very much for your time. And I'm
very much
open for any questions.
Yes, any questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll apologize for my many questions today, but
that's okay.
As you already know, this is very close to my heart. Representative Tomei, thank you for all you do, and I appreciate it. And are you aware that April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month?
Yes, I am, Representative.
Thank you. All right.
Just that's found that point. Out today.
Thank you for bringing that up. I appreciate it.
Any other questions? Okay, and since most of these commissions are the minority commissions, do you think the Women's Commission should be included in as advocacy minority commissions? Because women are not minorities, though. By number-wise, they're more than men.
Thank you, Representative Lemon. You bring up a wonderful point, and I think if you look at this body here today, you will see that women are underrepresented in the legislature. And so I think this is one of the reasons why we need to advocate for women in all walks of life.
All right. I don't think anyone can dispute that. All right. If there's no more questions, thank you very much, Representative Tomei, for coming to testify.
Chair Lim.
Thank you. All right, now we are on again. Thank you for your patience, and who is going to go first? All right, and Carol Suzuki, thank you and welcome.
Thank you. Chair Lynn and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2013. For the record, my name is Carol Suzuki, and I am chair of the Oregon Commission on Asian Affairs. I volunteer my time and my relationships in the Asian American community because I believe the mission of the Advocacy Commissions is a critical one. The Commission on Asian Affairs became a statutory commission in 1995. With the good leadership of then-Senator John Lynn. Over the years, it has faced many budgetary challenges while doing its best to establish itself as a resource for the Asian American community and state government. Each advocacy commission is the product of years of enormous community effort just to be before you today. As an advocacy commission for Asians in Oregon, we serve a very diverse population. The traditional Asian ethnic groups of the Japanese, Chinese, Korean, Filipino, and Vietnamese fall under our umbrella, but we also represent Middle Eastern ethnic groups such as Syrians, Iranians, and many more. The most recent census data has shown that Asian Americans now make up 3.2% of Oregon's population. While that percentage may seem small, it actually represents over 100,000 people statewide. For some, the Commission served as their first contact for assistance. Over the years, we have referred numerous people to state and federal agencies after receiving the initial contact. In the recent past, we organized an Asian Heritage Celebration at Pioneer Courthouse Square, an Asian Home Buying Fair, joint meeting with the OLCC and Asian American business owners, held an outreach meeting in Medford, and heard concerns regarding assisted living facilities, and participated in or facilitated speaking engagements to groups and classrooms to promote greater cultural understanding. Most of these activities stopped when we were forced to close our doors and surplus all commissioned furniture and possessions in early 2003. During the interim, a small work group continued to meet and called upon Governor Kulongoski to assist in finding a solution that would streamline our operations but retain the integrity of the individual commissions. We are very pleased to be here today in support of House Bill 2013 with amendments. It creates an Oregon Advocacy Commission's office that would serve as an administrative agency to the four commissions. The office would provide badly needed administrative support for the commissioners and allow volunteer commissioners to provide the services we once did when we had an executive director and funding. The amendments to House Bill 2013 will amend the bill so it will mirror the governor's proposal. As mentioned by Lynn Parton, as you will hear in further testimony, the creation of this new agency in place of the four separate advocacy commissions will provide considerable savings. The legislature asked for a lean and streamlined plan that reduced even further the commission's reliance on scarce general fund dollars. This is that plan. By reducing historic barriers for people from different ethnic backgrounds and women, the advocacy commissions provide added value and increased reach to diverse sectors of the state population at a very minimal expense. We hope you agree that the advocacy commissions serve an important purpose and fulfill a critical need in state services. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Okay. The Vice Chair Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Suzuki, can you describe for us when you lost funding and how that impacted what the Commission on Asian Affairs was able to do?
it impacted us greatly. The first thing that we had to do was to terminate immediately our executive director. And then because she was gone, it fell upon the members to effectively shut down the office, cut the phone line, the fax line, terminate our email. And so what I did, basically as chair, was to have the mail sent to my home, and spend my personal hours outside of work, volunteering my time and responding to calls about housing discrimination or whatever. But after we surplused we put our furniture into storage first within a DAS warehouse, and everything was shrink-wrapped. And not long after that, we received news that, A, we were going to be charged rent to have our things there. And you know, we had raised some money over the years, maybe a couple $1,000, and so every month we were losing $60 for storage. And then not long after that, we were told that the state could no longer store our things, and that we, in order to, again, maybe raise some more money, they asked us to surplus the furniture that we had taken 10 years to accumulate, basically, and pay for. So we don't have any computers or desks or anything. I think the only thing remaining is the file cabinet that houses our historical records, and that is in storage currently.
If I can follow up, Mr. Chair. It sounds like the loss of funding really paralyzed the activities of the commission. Would it be fair to frame it that way?
Because we were all volunteers who were not taking any kind of reimbursement for our meetings, because we knew that the budget was tight, and you know, we could never count on a particular amount of money from the legislature. So, for example, we had members coming from as far away as Medford and Roseburg who were choosing to not take a mileage reimbursement for housing, I guess, in order to allow the commission to save resources.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Representative Muckley. Buckley, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I become Representative Muckley on this committee. Ms. Suzuki, I'm trying to get a kind of picture of the economic impact of the bill. Representative Tomei was very informative with her comment about the ability to bring in federal funding through the commission. Are there other potential cost savings to the state that would be found through the establishment of the office as initiated?
I think basically, by each one of there were four commissions, and so each had an executive director, which was paid a salary. We also had to pay DAS charges. 30%, I would say, of each of our budgets went to DAS, basically for upkeep and so forth. And so So when you combine these commissions, you only have one set of DAS charges. So there is a savings there.
Very good.
So, and I think just a little later in the testimony, we'll have some more information about the savings. But we had asked the budget and the budget office, the governor's, the budget office for some figures, and it says that the governor's recommended budget for 05-07 consists of $375,000 in general fund to fund two staff positions and necessary administrative expenses, and then to fund the four advocacy commissions as four separate entities, with each commission having its own executive director. The estimated cost for 05-07 is $832,155. So as you can see, there is considerable savings.
Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, and Carol, you are excused for a while, and I have a Representative Farr here with us. Where's Representative? Since you are, would you please come forward and give us the testimony? And
Representative
Lim,
I'm here to testify on Bill
31.
Oh, that's a different one?
That's the next one.
Actually, the second bill.
Okay, I apologize. All right.
You might want to ask if she wants to testify right now. You could open that up for her.
President.
I have a question.
Okay, let's go.
Mr. Chair.
And Representative Farr, how tight you are tied?
I'm good.
You are good?
Okay.
We'd like to keep you here for a while. Thank you. Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Suzuki. Is that right?
Yes.
Do you have figures? I don't find it, and maybe the governor's office had it, of the number of Asian Americans here in our state who are citizens and those who are working on it?
Right now, I can get back to you with that information. The last census data showed that Asian Americans made up 3.2% of the state's population, and that's a little over 100,000 people.
I'm curious of how many are here who are already citizens and how many are likely working on their citizenship. I think it's a tribute to you.
Thank you. I would guess that the majority would be citizens or working on it, but I can certainly get back to you with that information.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? If not, Carol. And the Asian Commissions, how many ethnic groups are together in Asian Commissions, since it's so diverse?
Well, with the expanded definition, including Middle Easterns, I would imagine it would be anywhere between 40 to 50.
That's quite a few.
Yeah, numbers. So it's a challenge to effectively represent all of those groups. As a commission, we've tried to get the widest representation of ethnic diversity on our commission, as well as getting members statewide from all regions of the state rather than just the Portland metro area.
Okay. Do they have mostly their own dialogue or any of the groups speaking same languages? Like, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, and all speak different languages, even though they're all Asians.
Well, to the extent possible, we try to get people to come together and celebrate our similarities, I guess.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Who's going to the next? Okay, you are
Johnny Lake, Chair, Commission on Black Affairs.
Okay. Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Lim and members of the committee, it's an honor to speak here before you as a representative of an entire community of Oregonians who have historically struggled to be included in this state, from a history where blacks were specifically excluded because of the color of their face. We have made incredible progress. But if you look around this capital, you recognize that underrepresentation continues to be a problem, as was mentioned by the legislator here concerning women. And so we continue this struggle in a democratic process that hopefully includes the voices of the citizens. That is where the commissions have historically served an incredible role as a connection and a conduit between the legislature here and the citizens that you most times don't see and don't come to this Capitol. And so in the process of working for those citizens, the commissions have often been framed as advocates or as activists, but really we are working for inclusion of citizens in the democratic process. And so as we argue for these commissions, I certainly appreciate the work of all of you in attempting to frame a way that we can include these commissions again in this conversation. Simply looking at the impact of these commissions not being here, you almost have to look for the deficits, the things that don't happen because the commissions are not here, so that when those communities are not heard from, the absence of a commission becomes incredibly important. Citizens have asked what happened to the commissions. Citizens have asked why were they not funded. Citizens have called and emailed We, as volunteers, have struggled to continue to provide a certain visibility and a voice for these citizens, encouraging them to participate in the process. I encourage you to think of what we are attempting to build as a community of people. When we have to continue to look at minority people and women in the deficit, so that in this day, this 2005, women and minorities still continue to earn less than 60% of what the average white male Oregonian earns in this state. And that's today. That's not 50 years ago. And so for these citizens who continue to operate from a deficit, what kind of state can we have if we promote the advancement of the minority communities and the women? What if we graduate all of our children from schools with equal opportunities as minorities and women? What kind of state will we have just one generation away? And so the work that these commissions do, I think you won't see the outcome this week, this month, this year. But in the next generation of people that we are able to help and we are able to impact, I think you will see incredible results from the small amount of money that we are investing now in these same communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, Johnny, and are you serving the commission at this time?
Yes.
What commission is it?
Commission on Black Affairs. I am the current chair.
You are the current chair.
Yes.
Okay, thank you for coming.
Yes.
And since the establishment of a Commission of Black Affairs, which was 1985, was it? It has been about more than 20 years ago the commission has been established. And what do you think made the differences of the Commission of Black Affairs to the Afro-American citizens?
The impact has been broad in the sense that the establishment of a specific office to address issues of the community has created a line of communication that the community has become very aware of. As the commission increased visibility through different activities in the community, it became the conduit for citizens to speak to the legislature here. Their issues would come first to the commission, where the commission could help them to frame it into a viable communication, and then we could direct citizens to which part of the legislature was the right place for them to go. So in the legislative sense, the commission represented the first line of contact for many of the citizens. The commission picked up issues around health in the African American community, which are incredibly disparate issues around health in the black community. And the commission became a place that the community could seek out information around specific issues such as diabetes, hypertension, some of the issues that create problems, I think, for our entire state. The commission's also created opportunities for young people by doing youth leadership conferences. Willamette University sponsored us for 2 years. We've done leadership conferences at Chemeketa, and it's been very well received. And right here in Salem, we had over 250 African-American youth who attended a conference at Willamette University. Just bowled me over because I didn't know it was that many young African-American youth in this city. You don't see them. You don't hear from them. And we promote for those students an awareness of higher education and what it can do for them. They make connections there, and I have subsequently seen some of those same students become students at Willamette University, soon to become vital contributors to this community. The commission has also worked with different organizations to increase their representation of minority employees, so that for many employers, the commission itself was a very good resource for them to locate and be able to recruit from minority communities. That's just a few of the things I can think of at the top of my head.
The Vice Chair Mokley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lake, did you lose funding in 2000 2003 or 2001. Can you describe how that impacted your ability to operate effectively in promoting these issues?
We lost funding, and we therefore lost the only funded person that was in the commission. The executive director was gone, but we had an executive director that volunteered some of his time, so we attempted to maintain communications. Funding was gone, so we lost our office location. Then we lost the telephone and the computer connection, and subsequent to that, we have struggled on an individual basis to maintain a presence of communication, but we had to close down everything. And for many citizens, I think they perceive the commissions as being gone, which is, I think, considering the history of the commissions and the work that I think we all have done to increase participation of communities, I mean, the idea that the commissions are gone is a real, I think, problem. But the funding for us was critical to maintaining any type of services, and out of 10 people, 9 were volunteers working for no reimbursement for mileage. We had people from all over the state as well who would come here so far away that they had to stay overnight, but none of that was charged against the commissions. We used the money very wisely in attempting to maintain services for the communities. So when those funds were gone, the commission effectively was out of business.
Representative Mockley. I'm sorry. Mockley, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lake, is it the role of the commission to suggest legislation and to track legislation and to communicate possible impact of legislation to members of the community?
That was a very important role of the commission, and that's one of the ways I think the citizens did look to us, in fact, held us accountable for keeping up with things that were happening in the Capitol and being able to translate even what that meant for the community. And I think that that is one of the real critical roles that as a legislator I would like you to think about, because that conduit is so important in the process of democracy, so that citizens do get an accurate and complete understanding of what's going on with legislation and also get to weigh in with their own voice. So that I think for the citizens, and when I think about a couple of pieces of legislation, we were held as accountable as you guys are for that legislation by our communities as to what it meant, why did we not communicate this to the community, what do we need to do. So I think a great question and a great example of the democratic process, so the citizens find a way to participate in what goes on in the Capitol here.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things I've heard from the two commissioners so far is that when you lost funding, you lost your office and your one-person staff. And I'm wondering if we create this Oregon Advocacy Commission's office, is that going to be a central office for all of the commissions, or will each of the commissions again have an office space for themselves? That's probably a question that goes to the governor's office, but I'm not sure. Answer to that question?
All right. Thank you, Lynn. Yes.
Chairman, Representative Riley, again, for the record, my name is Lynn Parton. I'm here on behalf of the governor's office. What we were trying to do is provide administrative support to all the commissions. Carol Suzuki talked a little bit about trying to maintain the integrity of each of the organizations, but trying to streamline the administration. And so this would only provide two positions to all four commissions, and hence the more than 50% savings over what it would cost to have an executive director for each one. This is really the only game in town, unfortunately. And this is about the extinction, frankly, of three of the commissions and whether the fourth will continue to be hobbled. And we're really trying to look very hard at what could we realistically hope to accomplish, and we don't want them to die.
Thank you. Quick follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
Thank you. What I understand is that there will be a central office which emails, phone calls, etc., will all come into all the commissions. Is that going to be
correct? Chairman Representative Riley, I am not sure that it has been fleshed out to that extent. DAS will be in charge of it. They're the appointing authority. I would hope, certainly, I can't speak to what they're going to do, but I would certainly hope that they would have individual email addresses. I don't honestly know that. I can't speak for the way DAS would set it up. But the DAS 1 amendments also deal with an issue that had come up about making it more collaborative between DAS and the commissions. It used to just say DAS was the appointing authority and they called the shots, and the DAS 1 amendments require collaboration with each of the commissions, so they should be able to get their two cents in about what they want.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you please still hear, this probably goes to the governor's office, this question. I'm a little bit confused in that I hear discussion about how all three or maybe four with the women's commissions will be embodied within this, but then I read within the bill itself that these commissions are being abolished, ostensibly for cost-saving reasons. Can you clarify what we have here? I'm under the understanding from the bill that we are creating one commission, one advocacy committee, if you will, to handle all of the minority concerns and abolishing all the existing commissions. Am I reading that wrong?
Chairman, Representative Green.
It's reading the original bill.
Oh, okay. Thank you. If you look at, I've had some advice here about whether you're looking at the amendments or the original bill, but if you also look at the governor's recommended budget pages that I provided, I-14 and I-15, it describes how the two staff positions and necessary office expenses are what are provided by the 2.26 full-time equivalent positions. And can you repeat the question exactly?
Well, basically my question was, and I think I already see the answer, the question was the difference between the bill and the amendment, I suppose. My understanding of the original bill was to save costs, was to,
right,
to streamline by,
yes,
by combining, if you will, all the functions of the existing committees, but then eliminating those committees and replacing that with one,
right,
Oregon Advocacy,
right,
Committee. Now what I see, correct me if I'm wrong, is we're keeping all of those committees plus adding one, and I guess I'm still struggling with that. If that's the reality, how we're saving costs.
Chairman, Representative Boone, what we're doing is keeping each of the commissions with their 11 members, and so they're going to have their, that's the part about maintaining the integrity of each of those commissions, is they're going to still have their boards that they report to the extent that there's funding available, they'll get per diems or mileage or whatever. That again is subject to availability of funding. So there has not been funding for that. So they will each still have their separate boards, but they will have a combined administrative support function. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Pardon me, Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Ms. Parton, why don't we just give these commissions the money and let them run them? Why are we, you know, dishing out two for everybody? And, I mean, why don't we just divide the money among the commissions and let that go toward their office expense? I know the Hispanic Affairs Commission met somewhere else,
prior to this. I don't know why we're doing this, and I want to know if we're paying Department of Administrative Services their customary 16% of what we're getting, which is ridiculous.
Chairman, Representative Nelson, we would love to have all four commissions fully funded. We would love
I'm
nothing
not, I know, I'm just saying, I understand it isn't. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, follow up. I'm just trying to clarify. I know they're not fully funded. I'm just saying, why have we said, okay, you can have two for everybody, and why don't we just give that money to the commission, reestablish the commissions as they were, divide the money among them, and not pay DAS 16% for running this program.
Chairman, Representative Nelson, I don't think the DAS charges go away depending on how you
they
break
should.
That up. Well,
we don't need them.
Chairman, Representative Nelson, I think if you provide two FTE, 2.26 FTE, which this provides for, but however you slice it, the DAS charges are going to be the same. And you could set it up so that each one has a half-time equivalent. The idea was that there would be some administrative streamlining that would be available by having two people support all the commissions, that there would be some overlap in function, and that would be the way to go.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
One follow up.
Thank you, sir. I'm just saying, you know, we're dictating to them. I think they know best what serves them. And my bet is it's not what we've established here. We don't need DAS. These are commissions for various minority groups in our state. We don't need DAS at all. If they had been doing their job to begin with, we wouldn't have to have all these different commissions. They would have had advocacy groups within DAS. So I'm just saying leave DAS out, give the money to the entities, and let them use it as, you know, they see fit.
Chairman,
everyone, including the European community.
Chairman, Representative Nelson, I believe Francisco Leva Johnson would like to respond to that.
And before we respond, I believe that as a courtesy and also the time constraint, Senator Devlin is here. And so if you excuse, and just you can stay there. I do appreciate your patience. Welcome, Senator Devlin. Glad to see you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I will not speak with the eloquence of many of the parties that have been before you, but perhaps I can shed a little light on some of the issues that have come forward. Many of the parties that will come before you probably talked about the history of the commissions, and it's kind of interesting to me that three of the commissions, the Commission on Black Affairs, the Commission on Hispanic Affairs, and the Commission on Women, all were created in 1983 at the beginning of the second term of Governor Victor Atiyah. Governor Atiyah was known for recognizing the growing diversity of this state and also recognizing the role of this state in terms of its future, in terms of a world economy. He was one of the first people to hold that position that actually took very clear views on both of those issues. Of course, Senator Lim was the founder and creator of the Asian Commission on Asian Affairs in the 1995 session.
Hey, Senator Lim.
Thank you.
And many people that are before you here will talk about the importance of the commissions in terms of providing a voice for various communities in the state and recognizing the diversity of the state and also increasing the participation of those communities in state government and in the policies that we put forward here, that we adopt here. One of the issues I'd like to talk about is why you have the bill before you. I was a member of the Subcommittee on Ways and Means on General Government in the last session when we basically defunded all of the commissions. We basically had to do that because it was pretty much the direction of the co-chairs at that time that there would be no general funds available for them. We gave them all other funds, basically other funds allotments in a sense, and what that basically means is if you go out and raise the money, you can spend it, because if you're a state entity, you have to have an other funds appropriation to be able to actually to function. Now, the Commission for Women was able to maintain functioning almost for the entire biennium. It's in a considerable trouble right now. The other commissions basically were put in a situation where they basically had to fold. One of the reasons I think that this bill is before you is for a very clear reason, and that is that the budget constraints that we are under and some of the ways that we might approach this a little bit differently. The former structure of the commissions on average each biennium, at least the bienniums when they were funded, averaged about $600,000 to $700,000 in general fund dollars. What you see before you is approximately about half of that. One of the reasons why I think that this is a good arrangement is I do believe to some extent that the commissions were set up for problems from the very beginning in the sense of how they were structured. That's because they were basically given one FTE each, one person each. If you are the person that answers the telephone, that sets up the committee meetings, that answers all of the correspondence, that literally does every single task, and you're the only person, it actually, in a tendency, limits what you can actually do. Two or three people working together can actually do more than three people separately. And that's one of the things that's been advocated. We presented some proposals to the co-chairs in the last biennium about restructuring the commissions like this. It wasn't exactly like this. I think the recommendation we came forward with was to put the three advocacy commissions, the Commission for Hispanic Affairs, the Commission for Asian Affairs, and the Commission for Black Affairs, in one group, and then to basically make an allocation like Representative Nelson advocated directly to the Women's Commission, and basically rather than tell them exactly what to do, to basically provide them some subsidy and funding. But I think this is the, as it was said by the governor's representative very emphatically, this is the only train leaving town for the commissions. This is the one way that we can continue the commissions, continue what Governor Atiyah thought was very important, what then-Senator Lynn thought was very important, and I think this is the way that we need to go in this particular session. I know that the director for the Commission on Women may have stated this, and I should disclose for the record that one of my 11 appointments during the interim and one of my appointments now is I am the Senate representative to the Commission on Women. Maybe say something. I'm the token male representative to the commission on women. But one of the things that I, hopefully the executive director, and I believe she probably touched upon, is the very important role that they play with AmeriCorps. We have an AmeriCorps contract that's administered by the Commission for Women. To be quite honest, if it was administered by any state agency, it would cost AmeriCorps a lot more money. That normally has about 24 to 27 volunteers that work throughout the state. All of their wages are paid for by AmeriCorps. They actually reimburse the commission for some of the administrative costs. Those 24 to 27 individuals work on domestic violence issues throughout the state. AmeriCorps has made it very clear that they don't intend to relocate again, and that if the commission goes away, those 24 or 27 volunteers may go away. As a member of Ways and Means, I can tell you if that was a public agency out there and we had 24 to 27 people working on domestic violence issues, it would cost us probably $2.5 to $3 million a biennium. That's one of the very clear benefits of the Commission for Women, and one of the benefits that they have provided to this state, along with providing a voice on a number of issues and along with actually providing some sounding board on legislation that comes before this body. I would encourage you to pass House Bill 2013 with the -1 amendments out to the Ways and Means Committee with a dues pass recommendation, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions? If not, it's well spoken.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. And Representative Farr, and would you would like to come forward at this time, or what is your choice?
Representative,
I would prefer waiting until you get to the bill. Oh, okay. You have a different bill. I was thinking the same. Somehow you are connected with the Commission of Women's, I thought. Anyway. You are? Okay. Okay, let's go ahead without interruption then. Thank you for your patience, and pardon me for the interruption. Thank you. And who is next going to be? All right.
I was going to answer.
Francis, right?
Francisca.
No, Francisca. Good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Lim,
Vice Chair, and members of the committee, it is with great pleasure that I present my, that I am allowed to speak here today regarding Hospital 2013. I was going to answer Representative Nelson's question, but I'll wait until she comes back.
Okay.
I am Francisca Leva Johnson, and I was appointed to the commission in April of 1998. I am here representing myself and one commissioner left on the commission. His term expires this August. The commission has 9 community positions, of which only one position is filled at this time. My term expired in April of 2004. I have continued to meet with this group, to work for this bill on my own volunteer time, because I'm passionate that the Hispanic Commission and that all of these commissions be represented here in this legislative body. Latinos represent over 9% of the Oregon population, yet only 39% of the population have the power to vote. This means that over 183,000 Hispanic Latino families, men, women, and children, are excluded from the political process that empowers every community. The Oregon Progress Board's most recent report on racial and ethnic minorities declared that Hispanics are most likely to lag behind on important Oregon benchmarks. It states that for 2002, Hispanic Oregonians were farther behind than their non-Hispanic counterparts in all of the Oregon benchmarks examined: high school and college completion, eighth grade reading and math skills, high school dropout rates, health insurance coverage, prenatal care, poverty, and home ownership. In many cases, Hispanics were further behind non-Hispanics now than they were a decade ago. I have prepared for you a packet with information regarding the commission's work prior to losing funding. The commission has always prioritized opportunities for our youth and families. The commission has provided youth summits which have touched the lives of over 400 students and awarded thousands of dollars in scholarships. The information I have provided you shows the 2002 youth summit presentations, and I personally am looking forward to being able to provide a youth summit in 2006. You will also find information on the commission's webpage. Unlike my counterparts, I had an outside webpage for the Hispanic Commission. It just recently got moved into the governor's website. So we have had the opportunity to have access, or the community has had access to us through our website. And what's listed in that website is my personal cell phone number. Okay. I have, because of the 36 years in this community and the work that I do for the City of Eugene and its human rights program, developed an incredible amount of networks to be able to refer any of the issues and complaints with regard to any of the protected classes throughout the state. I've been very fortunate in the work that I do and my allies when our community, hits a roadblock. I've been able to refer it out. It's been an incredible amount of work. Because of the loss of funding, recruiting people to apply to serve on our commissions has been an incredibly difficult task. As I stated earlier, my term expired a year ago. We have one person left. He's actually in Iraq, so he's not available, but his term does expire in August. We will be left with no one. I do understand that our state Senate representative is Courtney?
Peter Courtney.
Senator Courtney. And Representative Donna Nelson was our last, representative on the commission. And right now we don't have anyone. We are struggling. We are struggling. The community continues to do the work within their communities. Please know that. We have allies. For example, one of the pieces that I've provided for you that we used to have on our website, that we used to update weekly when we were funded, is our legislative alerts. It not only showed the bills that were kicking at our community, all of our communities, it showed who were on the committees, and the alerts are for not only awareness of our community of what those bills are that are kicking at us, but it's also to give you the support that you need for those bills that are beneficial to our communities. It's a double, you know, it's a win-win situation when we are able to do this and to be able to let our community know who needs, you know, support from us as you go through your legislative process. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to do it, so one of our allies is doing the same thing we did before. Pocoon is providing a list. It's also in there, so you can see some of the bills that are affecting the Hispanic community today. I thank you, Representative Lim, and members of the community for this opportunity to speak with you today. I hope the information I have provided gives you a better understanding of the outreach provided by the Commission. The Commission is a model that represents the commitment of the legislature to address the economic, social, political, legal, and educational inequalities that plague Oregon's 300,000 Hispanic Latino community members.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, Representative Buckley now. I got to write this.
Thank you, Jim. Francisco, thank you for your testimony. Can I safely sum up what you just said, is that the Hispanic Commission is hanging by a thread at this point since the cuts that have taken place. Your work has been diminished down to a shadow of what it was, and you simply do not have resources at this point to continue?
Right.
Thank you.
Now that Representative Donna Nelson is back, I'd like to answer the question that you had before about you know, why it makes sense for all of us to be together. By statute, we have obligations to follow the open meetings laws. We have obligations to be very careful about how we do our process. And without someone here to set out a public meeting notice that the commission is going to meet, we can't do that. Making decisions on behalf of the state when we don't have quorum. As I said, we only have, you know, a few of us actually, only one of us actually an appointed member at this point in time. It makes it very difficult. By statute, we have obligations we have to meet, and without someone watching what needs to be done, it creates a real problem for us to be able to do it.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. It's nice to see you again. Let me just give you this concept. I'm just trying to protect your money.
I want to get this here.
Now, what we're saying is that there's not a chair of one of these commissions who would like to work full-time in this office, or we're not saying that we would like to take this sum of money and leverage it to get matching funds somewhere else. To run our own office. So, you know, we talk about unique problems, and we all have unique problems. And so I'm just saying, you know, it's one thing to have administrative help, but to pay DAS, you know, additional sum, 20% of what you're getting, is ridiculous. And I'm just urging you to think it over. You could have, Ms. Suzuki, you could have an Asian American woman running this. I mean, filling two positions in one because you understand. And we could have, you know, an individual representing, you know, other groups in that office if you're determined to have one office. But we function all over the state, as you know, right now. We're all over the state having meetings. It's no big deal. You know, once you get trained to, you know, set up those type of hearings or meetings. I mean, it isn't cumbersome. I mean, it's just a responsibility. I'm just trying to save your money. I think it'd be better if each one of you took your money and leveraged it and didn't pay gas because you don't need them.
All right. Yes.
The funding question has always been a concern and a problem because there's never been enough money. Even with double what they are saying they can fund now, we could only pay for the one employee. And I think what they're doing now is attempting to squeeze that down and cut it in half and pay for whatever FTEs that will pay for and allow that to serve all of us. If it was split four ways and we got what one-fourth of what the current funding is.
$107,000, which is a considerable amount.
I think it would be really hard to fund anybody in a viable position that somebody could...
$100,000?
If that was all going to an employee, that would be great. But I think the way, and I'm not a DAS expert...
Well, then we expect the commission members to make a lot more than the rest of Oregonians.
No, but I'm not a DAS expert. I don't know where the original funding went, but the way it was allocated, it would only pay for the one employee. And so if that's cut in half, I guess DAS could probably answer that question best. If that was cut in half, how could you fund an employee with half of what they used to fund one employee with when it was double?
That's fine. When you are speaking, speak through the chair, not just the person to person.
Yes, sir.
Okay, that's the usual way we conduct at the committee meetings. Okay.
Thank you.
Yes. All right, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Francisco, welcome. As you probably know, I represent a community in Forest Grove, Cornelius, and Hillsboro. Has a very large Hispanic, Latino population. And so I'm very interested in you maintaining your commission. But I also want to invite you. I'm meeting with Central Culture Al Sabino. I'm sure you know Sabino. I'm meeting with him on April 8th at 6 o'clock. And we're inviting all the Latino community leaders to that meeting, and I'd like to invite you to join us if that's possible.
Thank you very much.
Okay, let's go ahead with the testimony. Okay. With the Amber, right?
Rosalind.
Yeah, Rosalind, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Where's that?
You didn't have your name here?
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, members of the committee. Excuse me. For the record, my name is Rosalind Farrington, and I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Commission for Women. And I won't spend a lot of time because my two commissioners spoke eloquently to the work that we're doing at the Commission for Women. But I did have a handout for you that highlights what we've been doing over the last biennium and what historically we have done at the Commission for Women. And what I say, I've been at the Commission for Women for 5 years, and what I like to say is right on the cover, the Commission for Women is a testimony to what is right in state government. We are doing outstanding work. We're doing fabulous work. And part of the reason we're able to do that is because we had the administrative money that kept our doors open. And like Representative Nelson said, we use that administrative money to leverage state dollars to provide services across Oregon. When I came to the Commission for Women, I was one staff person with the mission of advocating for the 1.5 million women of Oregon. We had no money for travel. We had no money to get across the state and do anything. And so what I realized almost immediately was the Commission for Women was a state agency, but we had to operate a lot like a nonprofit. We had to do our own fundraising. And the challenges that goes with operating like a nonprofit is many of the foundations say, are you a 501c3? And we say, no, we're a state agency. So they say, okay, well, we're not giving you any money. So not only did we have the opportunity to operate like a nonprofit, we had the opportunity to not have available to us many of the resources that nonprofits do, as well as having to follow the state agency rules and regulations. So what worked for us at the Commission for Women is I have, my first time in this room was 10 years ago when I worked for PERS. I worked for the executive director of PERS at that time. So I had 5 years of solid grounding in what it means to be a state agency before I came to the Commission for Women. So not only did I have a passion for women's equality and the equality of all people, I also had the sort of bureaucratic sense in me of the rules and regulations that I needed to follow to be an effective state agency. And I think this bill, what it does is if you hire an executive director, you have that person who's there doing all the rules and regulations of being a state agency. And then if you properly fund it, you have somebody representing each of the advocacy commissions doing the work and the programs and projects of the advocacy commission. So if you flip through the handout that I gave you, I'm just going to highlight a couple of things. On page 3, it lists all of our commissioners. My commission is fully staffed, all my members are All my commission slots are filled except for one. I have a commissioner from Roseburg, from Portland, from Warrington, from Hermiston, from Shedd, from Salem, and another one from Portland, and then my two legislative representatives. So we have been committed to maintaining statewide representation. And what we say when people call and say, I want to be a commissioner, the first thing we say is, let me tell you the history of the Commission for Women and what that truly means. So when they come in, they know that that they probably won't get reimbursed for their mileage. They probably have to bring sack lunches to meetings because that's just the limitations of the findings that we have as a commission. And then if you flip to page 4 of the handout, you know, the Commission for Women has been around since 1964. It's been in state agency since 1983. But if you look at the legislation that we've been involved in through the years, you see that, you know, I had somebody tell me this some quote by a woman that said, women will prevail. And that is the story of the Commission for Women, because no matter what we've gotten from the Oregon State Legislature as far as support and as far as, you know, go out and do it on your own, the Commission for Women has been creative about finding ways to keep doing its work and to keep trying to achieve its mission. And if you flip to page 8 of the handout, I just want to point out, page 7. I just want to point out the communities that we have served through our AmeriCorps program. So when I came to the Commission for Women, there was one staff person. I'm thinking we need a way to get out there and be able to affect women's lives in as many communities as we can in Oregon. So when we got this federal grant, we were able to put AmeriCorps members in all of these communities. So you see from 2001 to 2004 and 5, where we've been able to place AmeriCorps members. And those AmeriCorps members receive a stipend. AmeriCorps is like the domestic Peace Corps. So they don't receive a living wage. They just receive a stipend and serve over 1,700 hours over an 11-month period. And that's equivalent to about 40 hours a week of service. And we have attorneys. We've had attorneys out in Hillsborough at Legal Aid who represent women free of charge who want to get a divorce or who need to get restraining orders. And not only are we helping women have better lives, the people who serve in AmeriCorps members, their lives are transformed. We had one member who had just graduated law school, became an AmeriCorps member in honor of her mother who had been a survivor of domestic violence, and was just going to do her year and then go on about her business. Well, it so transformed her life. Today she's working in Bend at Legal Aid and has committed her life to service now. And that's just one of the over 60 AmeriCorps members that we've had in this program. So that's just one story of how this program really impacts the lives of Oregonians and help Oregonians have better lives, because that's what we're about at the Commission for Women. And I'm not going to talk about the dollars, because the dollars that we bring in are important to policymakers, but for me the important thing is really being able to do the work of the commission. I get a little crazy sometimes when I think of how hard I have to work to help people in this state have a better life. But because I'm a little crazy, I keep doing it. And on page 8, the final page, I just want to say that during the 0103 biennium, when we last received state funding, for every dollar of state funding we got, we raised $6 in federal money and local community dollars. So that means that, you know, not only was it the federal grant, we do the Women Achievement Awards dinner where people come in and honor the work of women, but those resources also served to support the programs and projects of the Commission for Women. We now have a direct donor program. When I came to the Commission for Women, we didn't. But now over 400 people have made a commitment to provide financial support to the Oregon Commission for Women over the next 5 years. It's called Voices for Women, and if you're not one, I encourage you to sign up today. And so I talked about the AmeriCorps program. So at the bottom of that page is what's been lost. These are the programs and projects that we funded through the fundraising that we did. But they're all on hold now because all the dollars that we raise now go to support my position. And I am at three-quarter time and have been at three-quarter time for about a year now. So it doesn't even support me on a full-time basis. But so when we had administrative support from the state of Oregon, you know, that kept the doors open, that paid the bills, that paid the DAS service charges, and every other penny that we raised went to do a quarterly newsletter, went to provide educational forums on women in financial wellness, women in health and wellness around the state, went for us to do reports, like Representative Nelson mentioned that April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. So ideally, if we were funded the way we were supposed to be funded, we would be providing information to each and every one of you about the status of sexual assault in Oregon. You know, about where women are, you know, what the ratio of women that are being sexually assaulted, how that's changed over time, and what we can do to make that better. That's what we're created to do, and that's what these other commissions have been created to do as well for their particular communities. But because we're, you know, raising money right now and fighting for our lives, I don't have the time or energy to put into that piece of our mission, because if I don't do fundraising, then we get to shrink wrap our stuff too and put it in storage, and that's just not acceptable to me. So, again, for the record, I'm Rosalind Farron, Executive Director of the Commission for Women, and I am in support of this bill. I do think it needs work, and I'm going to work with the Governor's Office and the Department of Administrative Services to make it a model that really works for us all. But I think the other commissions can be just as successful as the Commission for Women, and I think the partnership that we can create here, coming under one umbrella, is we have, you know, easy access to each other, easy access to sharing information, easy access for me saying, this is the model we use, here it is, you know, pick it apart and make it work for you, and we're able to support one another in that way. So thank you, and I welcome any questions from the committee.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions, Representative Bradley?
Thank you very much. I can see why the other commissions would like to be associated with you. I think you're quite dynamic, and maybe you don't need us at all, frankly, but I think you do. I think we can work together. And I just wanted to say I think women have a great spokesman in you. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, Ms. Farrington, you're awesome, and I already know that, and I know that's why we've been so successful, and here's my check.
Thank you for all you've done for us.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, thank you very much for your support.
Okay. All right. If there's no questions, thank you very much for your coming and for your serving, and I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any other person like to testify on this House Bill 2013? Okay. Look like you are Amber. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Lim and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kellen. I'm the lobbyist for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. We've always supported the commissions for advocacy with whatever we could give to them as far as support in the state budgeting processes. I appreciate the opportunity to have a hearing, and I appreciate the potential of getting the commissions funded again, and I would defer to the commissions for work on the bill to make it acceptable to both the executive department and the commissions, but we do want to go on record in support of the bill. Our members include the American Association of University Women of Oregon, Delta Kappa Gamma, the Salem YWCA, the Oregon Older Women's League, the Oregon Women's Political Caucus, and the Oregon National Association Organization for Women, which were, with all those members, we represent at least 10,000 women in the state and have individual members in addition.
All right, any questions? If not, could you give us your last name again?
Kelly, K-E-L-L-E-Y.
Okay, that's easy. That's my daughter-in-law's name anyway. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, is there any other person like to testify on this bill? If not, we are going to close the public hearing on the House Bill 2013. And I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2013. And before we go on, I'd like to have a couple of questions. And could you, from the Governor's Office, Lynn, and could you come forward, please?
Before we have a rep session, I have a...
Yes, thank you.
Chair Lim, for the record, my name is Lynn Parton, and I'm here on behalf of the Governor's Office.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And quickly a couple of questions concerning this, the amendment. We are trying to save that the money for the commissions. And with this amendment, did you mention we are going to save about 50%? And how do you think we can save the money?
Chair Lim, the information that I got from Satish is that, as you can see from the governor's recommended budget pages that I provided you, there's $375,000 in general fund to staff two FTE positions and the necessary administrative expenses that go along with that. The four advocacy commissions is four separate entities, with each commission having its own executive director, would be $832,155. So that's where the savings comes in.
Okay, so that each committee commissions, they are not going to have their own executive director there?
Chairman, no. They would have an office of an administrator and an assistant.
Then how can you coordinate with each commission if they don't have any person in charge of each commissions?
Chairman, the idea is that they would have functions which would be staff support. One of the examples that was given earlier, I believe, was, for instance, setting up meetings and making sure that there was compliance with regulatory requirements and so forth. And those would be skill sets that would cross all of the commissions and what they would need for support.
Okay, and one question I have is concerning the charge from the DAS. And when I was a senator, I was able to negotiate to reduce the charge for some commissions. They are, according to my understanding, they charge this outrageous amount in the small amount of commission funded. And do you think you can negotiate with the commissions and DAS and reduce their charges? I know they have to charge some amount, but the charging for the small amount, if it's a large sum amount, might be okay, but small amount, $20,000, $30,000, that's a lot of chunk money going away. Is it possible you can negotiate with them? And I'd like to talk to them also.
Chair Lim, I absolutely encourage you to do that, and I will investigate that. I don't know the answer to that question.
And would you give us the report after you negotiate with them what
absolutely.
The charge is going to be?
Absolutely.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Nelson.
I move that we table this vote on this bill because we've been asked to add amendments to it, and I think that would be a courtesy to these commissions. And also, we have a huge European sector in our state that isn't represented, and really what we're funding is one advocacy commission's center. We're not funding each individual commission as it should be funded. We are just funding one advocacy or one commission's advocacy, that's a terrible word, center. We're really not funding a position in each one of them. And my belief is that it would be best to fund a $50,000 position for each of them and include all minorities.
If you want to recognize it.
Okay, I'm recognizing the motion to table of this House Bill 2013. This is not a debatable motion, and that the those who support the to table this House Bill 2013 say aye. Those who oppose to table say no. So the call the roll.
Representative Bruin.
No.
Representative Buckley.
No.
Representative Dallin.
Excuse.
Representative Merkley.
Excuse.
Representative Nelson.
Nay.
Representative Riley.
No.
Chairman?
No. All right. This motion failed. And
oh, excuse me, I misunderstood.
Yes, you say nay.
Oh, I was misunderstanding. I thought it was a nay that we proceed, Mr. Chair. Since I made my motion, I certainly support my motion.
Yeah, I'm sure. I was surprised.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood how it was being conducted.
Okay, so motion failed. And so the bill is on us to, and do we have a motion to pass this it's the dash one amendment, right?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment.
Okay, Representative Riley? Yes. Okay. Okay, we are going to call the Vice Chair Merkley, and we'll be taking this momentarily until that he comes.
Mr. Chair, is it possible to close this and open a public hearing so that the representative can?
I think that's the good suggestion, since we are time constraint, and I'm going to close the work session this time on House Bill 2013 and open a public hearing on the House Bill 3143. Thank you very much for the suggestions.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3143 eliminates the limitation on the number of enterprise zones that may be designated by the Oregon Economic Community Development Department. It eliminates the economic hardship requirements for enterprise zones, and it eliminates the 10-year limitation on enterprise zone designation. This would take effect the 91st day after sine die.
All right. And who should I go first?
Why don't you go
first? Okay, Representative Farr. Now.
Chair, may I bring Terry Connolly with me from the Eugene Chamber of Commerce?
Yes, of course. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Debbie Farr. I'm State Representative for House District 14. I am here this morning to testify in favor of House Bill 3143. My house district in Eugene is primarily working class families. And one of the things that I heard when I visited with those families continually over the summer was they are looking for opportunities for better employment. What we have seen in Eugene is a decrease in employment opportunities, and not only did I talk to people that were unemployed, I also talked to people that were underemployed and were looking for opportunities for greater income. So I wanted, my comments will be brief because I know that the real experts on enterprise zones are here, Terry Connolly from the Eugene Chamber, who's sitting next to me, and then in the back, Jack Roberts from Lane Metro Partnership, and they're the true experts on enterprise zones. But I just want to make a quick comment regarding some of the jobs that have been provided due to enterprise zones in Eugene. Hynix of Eugene is a great example. Hynix Semiconductor resulted in a net positive economic impact of over $226 million in local taxes paid. An electrical substation, taxes paid by employees, and spending generated by wages of employees. They now employ over 1,000 people, and they pay 6% of Eugene's general fund and are also the largest private employer. But Hynix, while that was a brand new business, and with economic development, of course, we talk about attracting new businesses, but we also understand the importance of keeping the businesses that are already in place and allowing them opportunities to expand. And some of those examples would be Land's Cabinets in Eugene, and I just had cabinets replaced in my home from Land's Cabinets, and one of their designers lives across the street from me, a young family man, and they're involvement with the Enterprise Zone and the ability it gave them to expand really is what provided him his job as a designer. Also, Glory Bee Foods, which is an interesting business. It started out as Glory Bee Honey, and the owner began the business in his garage. They now employ over 70 people. And Burley Design Co-op, which you may have read about in the news, the governor was there visiting a couple of weeks ago. I was there as well with two other Eugene representatives. And the businesses that I've mentioned are actually located in my house district, with the exception of Hynix, which is right on the edge of my house district. Many of the businesses that Mr. Connolly kindly provided me a listing of are located in my house district, and many of my constituents are employed there. So that's why I'm here today, to talk to you about the importance of providing employment, and I'm going to leave and allow Terry Connolly to give his testimony. Thank you so much for having me this morning, Mr. Chair.
Representing the FAR, thank you very much for your patience coming here to testify, and unfortunately, as you leave, also Vice Chair Moakley has to leave, so before he leaves, we need to have open a work session again on the House Bill 2013, so if you could give us a little time, I do appreciate it. And I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3143 and open a work session, House Bill 2013 again.
Okay, yes.
Representative Riley moved to adopt the Dash 1 amendment to the House Bill 2013. Any objection to adopting this bill? Hearing
none. Mr. Chair, yes, yeah. I do have an objection.
Yes, and one person, do we need to vote? Or
no, that's fine. Okay. So Mr. Chairman, what we'll show is Representative Collins is excused, Representative Nelson is voting no.
Okay, and it will show the record that way. And Dash 1 amendment adopted to the House Bill 2013. And any discussions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I am going to vote yes for this bill, but I just want to go on the record that I thought we should have been all-inclusive, that we should not have included DAS. I mean, 20% of a $12 billion state budget means DAS is making $2.4 billion off of all these agencies and commissions, and it needs to stop. I would offer my services instead, free. I'm sad that we're not listening to the requested amendments from the commission members.
All right. Thank you very much. And the comment has been noted and recorded. And any discussions? Any other discussions?
You don't have a motion right now. You need.
I don't have a motion. Okay, but you have a motion for that.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I move House Bill 2013 to be passed as amended recommendation, and that the measure be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
All right, and Representative O'Reilly moves that the House Bill, 2013, and that with the amendment to do pass recommendations. Am I saying correct? Okay. Sometimes I do the upside down, and then also that the refer to the Ways and Means. All right, any discussions? Okay, hold on, and I might say a few words, and I have a great concern of this this amendment. My original bill was intended to abolish all the commissions and into one commission, to save the money and the fundings, and I want to state that. But I directed my staff that the work with the amendment, not because I wanted, because each commission of each advocacy commission wants to work with that the not supporting my bill, but I'm willing to work with the commissions with the amendment. This is what happened, and so that I just want to express my sentiment. I'm going to watch this next 2 years how the commission function, actually saving 50%, and then if this works well, that's fine with me. I'm here to serve the people, not push my own bill. And so that as long as it's working good, it's fine. If not, then we might have to change it to some degree in the next session. You can count on that. So with that, I'm willing to give my full support with the amendment. And I thank you for the diligence of your work on this House bill and also the amendment. So that is my comment with that. And please call the roll.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Representative Gallant.
Excused.
Representative Merkley.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Aye. Thank you very
much. Representative Riley.
Aye.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Chair Lim.
Aye. And House Bill 2113 with amendment is passed, and this is referred to the Ways and Means. And do you think we got time to open up the other bills?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
And I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2013 and open again the public hearing, House Bill 3143. Mr. Connolly, we'd like to welcome you again here. Okay, Jack, and would you like to join us also at this time, or would you rather not to at this time? Yes. Okay. Jack, welcome again. Jack Roberts, the former Labor Commissioner and also a good friend of mine. And thank you very much for coming. And what's the other gentleman's name? Okay, Terry. Conley, welcome also. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Lim.
Yes.
Yes, Chair Lim and committee members. My name is Terry Connolly. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Eugene Area Chamber of Commerce in Eugene, Oregon. Thank you for providing this opportunity to comment on House Bill 3143. The Eugene Area Chamber of Commerce is comprised of 1,200 member businesses in Eugene and, in fact, from throughout the Eugene-Springfield metropolitan area. We are the largest advocate for business in that region of the state, and our mission is to promote a healthy local economy. I'm here today on behalf of the Chamber to support House Bill 3143. Our organization values responsible economic development and responsible economic development policies that help businesses grow and prosper. It's our belief and our experiences that as businesses grow and prosper, that's not only employing people, creating new careers, new jobs, but it also has a return value both fiscal and social to our communities. Business investment in our communities is a good thing. It needs to be encouraged. Sometimes investment comes in the form of companies relocating to a community. Other times it comes from local businesses expanding. Either way are good because, as I said, investment of business in our communities is good for economic development. And in that context, we believe the enterprise zones do play a valuable role. Enterprise zones are also an important tool for economic development because it's one of the few tools that the state of Oregon has to help businesses grow and expand and for economic development to occur. Yet there's limited access to them because of their limited number. The Eugene Area Chamber of Commerce believes or hopes that you will consider providing greater access to enterprise zones and as a tool for economic development, and House Bill 3143 provides that opportunity. Inasmuch as economic development incentives are seen to create a competitive advantage between cities, states, or even countries, enterprise zones are one viable option to make our state more prosperous. We are in a world where we compete for jobs and new investment. Enterprise zones are a performance-based tool that enables us to meet both community and statewide objectives. while enterprise zones are especially well known for attracting companies from outside the area to relocate, we would like to offer another perspective on the value of enterprise zones. And that is that enterprise zones are an effective tool for existing businesses in a community who want to grow or expand. And in today's global market, many businesses, they need to seize opportunities or to remain viable or to get into other markets. Expansion is important. And so we look upon reinvestment of those type of businesses as a very good thing for our local economy and for the economy throughout the state of Oregon. In Eugene's case, Eugene had an enterprise zone designation from 1987 to 1997. It was perhaps one of the most successful in the state of Oregon. And many people who were skeptics of the merit of the enterprise zone at that time are now starting to realize the value of it from the 57 companies who participated. And they're also starting to understand the consequences as we get the return of investment from those companies as to what the negative impact that has been to have lost that designation on Eugene's economy. I would mention, too, that of the 57 companies who participated in the Eugene Enterprise Zone during that time, 48 of those were existing companies in Eugene. And I think that's a comment that Representative Farr was just trying to stress to you as well. At this time, fortunately, there is a growing momentum within the city of Eugene to have Eugene apply for another enterprise zone designation, which we think is a good thing, and we think that based on the previous record of Eugene, the city should be able to submit a very credible application. The downside that we're looking at is the limited number of zones currently allowed in the state means that the reauthorization of a couple of existing zones or designating Eugene as a zone will create a winner or loser situation. And that's unfortunate when responsible economic development is the goal of so many people all across the state in rural areas and urban areas alike. Chairwoman, committee members, your committee meeting in Eugene on Friday will take place at Hynix Semiconductor. During your visit at that impressive facility, I hope it won't be lost on you that that company represents a great success story due in part to Eugene having had an enterprise zone designation. Together with the 56 other companies in Eugene who participated in the enterprise zone program, it proves just how valuable enterprise zones can be in the state of Oregon. To that extent, House Bill 3143 would create more access to enterprise zones for those communities who desire this kind of economic development tool. And for that reason, we think this bill is a good thing. Chair Lennon, committee members, thank you again for this opportunity to speak. I would happily answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Connolly, I'm so proud of y'all, and because of your accomplishments, I mean, it really lets other communities know what they can also accomplish. And I wonder if you're aware that we also passed a bill that gives you option now for an e-commerce zone as well.
Yes.
And to me, that's the number one bill in the legislature for economic development.
Chair Lim, Representative Nelson, I guess we are aware of that, and we appreciate all those tools of any kind for economic development. I mean, they're creative, they're new as economies evolve. All this is a good thing, and so, yes, thank you.
Any other questions? If not, and we are going to intend to be a public hearing by the 10:30, and so at least I want you to understand the timeline. And with that, we need to go ahead. Jack Roberts, welcome again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jack Roberts. I'm the executive director of the Lane Metro Partnership, which is a private nonprofit formed 20 years ago this year by the cities of Eugene and Springfield, Lane County, and by the Eugene and Springfield Chambers of Commerce. We're involved in trying to help keep and also recruit business and encourage growth and expansion in jobs and the diversification of our economy. And we're here also to testify in favor of House Bill 3143. With me is Jack Isselman. He's been representing us here, and we wanted to make sure you knew that he has been shepherding this through, and we want to make sure that you all understand that we're interested in working with you any way we can to try to help make this very useful and valuable tool more useful, more valuable, and more accessible. I'm going to try to be real brief. There's written testimony, I think, that's been passed out, but let me try to summarize it because I know we're running out of time. There are four basic things that we're proposing changing here. The first is to remove or perhaps simply readjust the definition of the economic distress for areas. The enterprise zone was originally a concept of trying to find out ways to draw investment to certain areas that are particularly distressed. It was originally proposed on the national level to help with inner cities. Frankly, it has not worked very well for that. The problem is that areas that are particularly struggling with the economic fundamentals find that a few tax incentives or other regulatory incentives generally aren't enough to draw investment there. What we and other states have found is that enterprise zones are a good way to help attract the types of businesses, and in Oregon it's defined as manufacturing, distribution, and call centers, basically traded sector activities, to create the business climate that will draw that investment there and that can create employment across the board. Oregon, consequently, over the years, in the almost 20 years that we've had enterprise zones, has continued to broaden that concept of economic distress. And in fact, in many communities today, what happens is you draw your lines to include your industrial areas. Those people who live there tend to be lower-income folks because other people are moving out in the suburbs. And so even in our most prosperous cities, we can carve out areas that we claim to be economic distress by drawing the lines, and we end up creating enterprise zones that are working effectively as economic development tools, but really are not a particularly effective tool of drawing investment to certain areas. What it's done in combination with the other things that we've done, such as capping the number, is we've created a competition among Oregon communities rather than now allowing each Oregon community to compete for jobs with other states. And so our belief is that by changing that definition, or frankly eliminating it altogether as a criteria, we not only eliminate the bureaucratic need to measure that, compete for that, and the rest of it, but we also recognize that this is an economic development tool for Oregon to compete against other states, not a way to pit one Oregon community against another. The second change, and this is the most important by far, if nothing else happens, something on this line needs to happen, and that is eliminating the cap on the number of enterprise zones. Currently, we allow 49 enterprise zones. When we started 20 years ago, it was at 30. Incrementally, we keep increasing that. Today, all 49 enterprise zones are taken. This year, there are two that come up for renewal. Eugene is trying to compete with those, but the two communities that have them, Madras and Harrisburg Junction City, want to renew that, so they're going to be competing. And so either Eugene is going to be turned down, or one of the other communities that has one will lose it. That doesn't seem to make sense. So we think that we need to have more zones. Frankly, if we see this not as a way to pit Oregon communities against one another, but as a way to empower every Oregon community that wants to have an enterprise zone to be able to have it, and therefore compete with other states, we think that makes this a better tool. And so we would recommend that you eliminate the cap altogether and allow any community that wants to be an enterprise zone to do so. If not, we would definitely urge you to have some increase this time so the communities that want to have it will be able to get it without denying another community that opportunity. The two other changes, one really follows from that, and that's, as was mentioned earlier, an enterprise zone is approved for 10 years and then has to be renewed. As long as you have a cap on the number, that makes some sense because that means that those who have them can't keep them from others and others are shut out. But if we eliminate the cap, there's no reason to have a time frame, and to allow community to adopt it and continue as long as they want to have it makes sense. Again, it doesn't require a bureaucratic effort on their part. If a community for a while isn't using it, it doesn't hurt anything. If you don't have any new investment, there's no lost tax revenue, there's no problem, but it's there ready to use if you want to. So that's another change that we'd recommend. And finally, the other change has to do with the optional ability that communities have now under some circumstances to expand the enterprise zone period from 3 years to 5 years. Let me stop here just real quickly to kind of review again how the enterprise zone works, because some of us who work with it all the time take for granted everybody else knows, and so it's good sometimes to remind ourselves. In an enterprise zone, if you are a manufacturing company, a call center, or a distribution center, and you're either locating there or you want to expand there, and are making at least $50,000 of new investment, and are increasing your employment by at least 10%, not fewer than one FTE. So even if you're a five-person business, you have to have at least one new person, full-time equivalent employee. If you do that, then you will not be charged for property tax on the new investment only for a period of 3 years. After that, it goes on the tax rolls and you pay thereafter. Under Oregon law, you can, at the discretion of the local government sponsor, and all these enterprise zones are sponsored by cities, counties, or a combination thereof, with their discretion, they can give you another 2 years if the wages that you pay, an average in that enterprise, are at least 150% of the average wages, that's wages and benefits, for that business, basically for manufacturing in that community. In Eugene Springfield area, Lane County today, that means you have to pay at least $45,000 a year in wages and benefits. Now, in many respects, that's a good requirement. And it means that companies like Hynix, who certainly meet that, are able to get this benefit. Others that don't pay as much get a 3-year, but they don't get the full 5-year. The law also provides that local communities can provide other conditions that they think is appropriate. What we're requesting is that local communities just be given the opportunity to extend it for 2 years based on whatever conditions they impose. That they certainly can, and we would encourage most of them to look at wage and benefit packages, but there may be other factors. A classic example, which I know you have been dealing with recently, is with food manufacturers, food processors, where you're dealing with, in many cases, the wages are not at the top end, but it's a strategically important industry for our state because it helps provide a market then for the agricultural growers and producers, and that some community might decide that they wanted to provide enterprise zone benefits for the full 5 years there, even though they don't meet the wage and benefit provision, and they ought to, I believe, have the flexibility to do that. Other communities might want to have sustainability measures that say if your industry is involved and meets certain sustainability practices, then even if you don't meet the wage practices, that gives you an incentive to adopt those practices for 5 years. That's something else we think is a good change. None of these are in concrete. If there's a feeling that some of these need to be changed or not, we're proposing this because we'd like to get people to start thinking differently about enterprise zone. The one thing that we are absolutely determined about and would hope that you would be willing to do this session is increase the number, if not remove the cap entirely, because we need to get some breathing room. The fact that all 49 enterprise zones that have been authorized have been taken is a good example that Oregon communities regard that as valuable. To force Oregon communities to compete against each other for this valuable economic development tool seems to be contrary to what we're trying to do. We believe that these changes will help make this more viable. Let me just quickly touch on two other things that might come up in terms of objections. One is, does this pit communities against one another? I think I've made it clear that rather than that, it really frees it to allow everybody to compete. The most important one that I know you're wondering about yourselves and will hear about is what's the fiscal impact of this. And the problem with that is it's very hard to measure what the true fiscal impact is. Because if you assume that all of this development would have occurred anyway, then we shouldn't even have them. We have to believe that we are inducing some new investment. We're keeping companies here that might otherwise leave, or we're attracting some companies that aren't, or enabling them to grow and expand. And if you believe that, then you have to look at the fact here that not a single dime of current revenue is lost here. Unlike some other tax expenditures where you can take a credit against your current tax bill, here all we're doing is deferring a tax on new investment for a limited period of time, after which it's all going to be on the tax rolls. And as Representative Farr mentioned, Hynix is a classic example of the upper end. That was a $1.2 billion investment that people in our community complained a lot for 5 years, said they weren't paying their share of the taxes, but now they're paying 6% of all the taxes that are collected in Eugene. We think that measure is a good one. But that's why looking at fiscal impact is a difficult one. I compare it to if you go to a department store and they're selling refrigerators and they say you can buy it on credit, no interest for the first 90 days. Some people who would have bought it anyway are going to get a heck of a deal by not having to pay interest for 90 days. But the retailers have figured out that their revenue is maximized by offering you that deal, knowing that you're buying the refrigerator, you're paying interest later. I think the same thing's true with communities that have adopted enterprise zones. Yes, they're giving up a little bit up front, but it's to get the long-term investment that creates the jobs and creates the opportunity. And what we're asking is that local communities have that option and that we make this as flexible and as usable a tool as possible.
Okay, thank you. Representative
Buckley. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Roberts, thanks for your testimony. I since we do are short on time, I'm hoping that you might be willing to come back if we are going to have further discussions on this. I'd love to hear what the League of Oregon Cities has to say and other folks involved as well. In just a quick hit on from my district, I live in Ashland, very affluent part of my district. Down the road, I also represent Phoenix. Poverty rate is almost at 50% now. The original idea of enterprise zones was to take something like Phoenix and say, how do we get economic activity going in a town like Phoenix? If we burst the cap on this and give Ashland the same ability to offer companies these advantages, companies going to choose Ashland, is it not, instead of investing in Phoenix where it's desperately needed?
Most of these companies Ashland probably wouldn't be recruiting anyway. We're talking about the manufacturing. So it's the Ashland economy is a little different than that. Land values are such that there are a lot of reasons why a lot of those companies probably would be looking at Phoenix anyway. But what I would tell you is that by and large, someone who is interested in the Ashland environment isn't going to look at Phoenix even with that. They're going to be looking at Eugene or Corvallis or the other college university towns. So the notion that somehow you're going to redirect that from one area to the other, I think is part of what we've really missed in this concept, that that's not the way companies decide how to do it. But the other point is, Ashland, best of my knowledge, doesn't have an enterprise zone, hasn't asked for one, because that's not the kind of development they have. So even if we open this opportunity, we're probably not going to develop it. Phoenix needs one, the other communities need one, and they have to use that as well as other tools. So I think this fear that somehow we're going to put those other communities at a competitive disadvantage has been misplaced, and over time, that's not really the areas that have gotten the enterprise zones. The Ashlands aren't the ones that have gotten them anyway, and I don't think that would make for a competitive disadvantage if they had that.
Just one quick follow-up. I appreciate that answer. I look forward to further discussion. Medford as well has, I think, done very well with enterprise zones, and it's helped the community of Medford. So I just have concerns about taking this very efficient tool and opening it up to a point where we lose the potency of it, and that's the concern I have.
I think that's a fair comment. The only thing I would say is that let's make sure as we look at that and review what's happened that we see what it is that's been so efficient, and that rather than seeing us weakening it, I think we're liberating that tool to make it even more accessible and more available because it has been successful.
Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Riley, we'll come back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One quick question, Jack. How do communities determine if they want to be participating in an enterprise zone? Is that a planning commission? Is that how does that work?
It's the government, Mr. Chair, Representative Riley. It's the local government, the city, if it's within the city limits, if it's in more than one city, as we have in some cases, both city councils have to approve resolutions making the application. If it goes outside the incorporated city, the county has to be a part of that. So it's the local governments who make that decision whether to do it or not.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nice to see you again, Commissioner. Why do you think that we eliminate a number of good businesses? For example, if Oregon Mutual Insurance applied for this, we couldn't accept them in our enterprise zone in Yamhill County. They're not one of the categories. Why are we doing this? I mean, why are we limiting anything? I know we talk about, you know, good living wage jobs, but, I mean, every one of those, however many employees, they have 1,000, I guess, now, make good wages.
Sharon, Representative Nelson, I think originally the concept was that they didn't want to make this available for retail or office buildings and others who basically are surviving on the local economy, and that they ought to be paying their taxes like everyone else, and that there was a fear that if, and I'll use the example everybody talks about these days, if a Walmart could come in and get an enterprise zone, which they cannot currently under Oregon law, how does Safeway and Albertsons and Fred Meyer's and those people feel about giving their competitor there? In the traded sector, the idea is that their competition isn't the people across the street. They're selling in the broader market, and we're trying to get that, because if they don't come here, it's not a question of are you going to be on in Eugene or Springfield, for example. It's usually, are you going to be in the Eugene-Springfield area, or are you going to be in Colorado Springs or someplace else? So it was designed as a way for a competitive advantage. Now, your issue is a broader issue of should we be providing some incentives for employers generally. I think there are a number of tools you could use for that in discussions, but when this was originally designed, it was not intended for that. It was really intended to be, as it sort of developed, a traded sector economic incentive to give us a competitive advantage for companies that could locate anywhere, and we want to get them here in Oregon.
follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
So apparently what you're saying is that we exempted the service industries. Evergreen International Aviation is now building the IMAX and has the museum, for example. We wouldn't include them. They're the largest property owner in Yamhill County. They're a service company. So I'm wondering if we should change this to include service companies like this.
That's a whole different issue. I don't necessarily have an opinion one way or the other on whether that would be a good idea. I just say that would be a very different use of the enterprise zone than what we've done before, because the issue of whether tourist attractions should be available for this is another issue, because that is a part of the trade sector. It was excluded initially, in part because there are a lot of communities along the coast where if they weren't taxing their tourism-based industries, they wouldn't be getting any revenue at all. So part of it is trying to get a balance that we have enough of a tax incentive to make a difference in the employment base without so undermining the overall tax base that we can't provide the basic services that keep the community vital. And that's sort of what you guys fight with every day. So I understand your issue, what you're raising. I thought we were biting off a lot with our bill. You'd be biting off a whole lot.
Very ambitious.
Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up. I'm not including retail yet. But, I mean, anything that creates a job, I'm for it. Right now, I've got 40% of the returning veterans, 10,000 returning to the Northwest who don't have jobs. And our governor hasn't addressed the issue. We're still not logging. So just like the e-commerce zones, anything we can do for good jobs in the state, we must do. But I'm wondering what category, I would ask y'all to think of this, what category a service industry like Oregon Mutual, we're corporate headquarters of that mutual insurance company. They have huge facilities. I bet there's not a person there that makes less than $40,000 a year, even in the clerical area, and that's a lot of people. So if we could entice New York Life to come build a headquarters in Eugene, would you accept them for the enterprise zone?
Well, sure, Representative Nelson.
They're kind of a call center.
If the law permitted us to do corporate headquarters, we'd love to see. I think corporate headquarters would be a very interesting addition. And just, as I said, I think we've bit off enough on this one. I'm not sure we want to jump into that. But if you want to do that, we'd certainly support you if you picked corporate or regional headquarters or some other things that would do that. But
Mr. Chair, I'll just add to that last one, please.
Okay.
Just one. But you see, we've even left out high tech. And I mean, which is number one in our e-commerce zone, we put them back in. But in this category, I mean, a call center, why we would even put that category in, to me, is ludicrous.
Representative Nelson, most high-tech, if it's high-tech manufacturing, is included. And that's why people like Hynix and others do qualify for that. The service centers... if they're doing national service, but high-tech calls, for example, Symantec in our community operates the service for security software, and it qualifies for the enterprise zone. So a lot of this does. It depends on how that definition is.
All right. Thank you very much. And then we are going to close our public hearing on...
Jack,
and I think we might have to take you some of the time.
Yield that
and,
time.
But I do appreciate your patience and time, and plus other person who are going to testify, but I will give you ample opportunity in the future. With that, we are going to close public hearing on House Bill 4143, and the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.